Support for The Full Story comes from Long Wharf Theater, creating theater of, for, and by the people of Greater New Haven. Everyone's story has a place at Long Wharf. You belong.
It seems the more we know, the more uncertain we are. And then we have more questions to know even more. Welcome to The Full Story on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak. We have a number of medical experts on the program today to answer your questions about the coronavirus. So the best way to get those questions answered is to go right now on our Facebook page, which is Full Story WSHU, and leave your question or comment there. Or you can email them to us at tfs@wshu.org. If you do that now, we'll try to get them over to the doctors in the next few minutes. Also, if you need to listen back to some of what you will hear today, you can download our show as a podcast. You can do that on Google Play, on Apple, Stitcher, Spotify, and you'll be able to stream it at WSHU.org. So if you're not able to write down everything that you're going to hear right now, listen a little bit later, and then you can go back and check things. We have a number of guests who have kindly consented to spend a good part of their day with us, with everything going on. And I'm grateful for their time and expertise so we can get the most accurate information out to our listeners. Dr. Anthony Santella is Associate Professor of Public Health in the School of Health Professions and Human Services at Hofstra University. Dr. Santella is with us via Skype. Dr. Santella, welcome. Welcome back to The Full Story. How are you, sir?
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Susan Dinellan is Medical Director of Healthcare Epidemiology at Stony Brook University Hospital, and she's joining us from our Long Island Bureau. Dr. Dinellan, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Thanks for coming on. And one more guest, Dr. David Bannick. He is an infectious disease doctor and hospital epidemiologist at UConn Health. Dr. Bannick, are you there, sir?
Yes, I am. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Thank you for your time. Dr. Santella, I am going to start with you because as we're all familiar now with the coronavirus, we know the disease it causes is named coronavirus disease 2019 or COVID-19. Now, we have had a number of medical experts on this program in the last year imploring members of the public to get a flu shot, to get the flu vaccine, because the flu can be deadly. And the flu kills between 300,000 and 650,000 people a year globally. In the U.S., I think the number is 20,000 or so from the flu in the last year. Is this coronavirus worse than the flu?
Well, we can't really answer that question right now. What makes this difficult is that it's an emerging, rapidly evolving situation. And so while there's been a lot of reports out that have indicated that it might be more contagious than the flu, more deadly than the flu, we won't really be able to assess that until this outbreak is over. But, you know, the silver lining of what's happening right now is people are paying attention to their own personal hygiene habits and maybe reconsidering getting the flu vaccine if they haven't already.
Dr. Dinellan, is the coronavirus spread more easily than the flu? And do we get it the same way as we get the flu?
Well, the efficiency if its transmission has really yet to be determined, as your other guest noted. Much of what we look at in terms of how sick people get and how easily it spreads is kind of a rearview mirror type of picture. We do know that it does have similar transmission mechanisms in terms of the vast majority of them are probably on the basis of sneezing and coughing and close proximity to others who are ill.
Dr. Bannick, over the last number of days, I spoke to as many people as I could just to get their reactions and questions, and I made a list of what they said, and I'm going to include a few of them today. Three of them had almost the exact same thought, that this is an overreaction. The flu, this is what they were saying, is just as bad, if not worse, and you don't see people panic when they get the flu. And they all said this is being hyped by the media, and I want you to know that it. Two of the people that said this to me, one was a very, very progressive liberal, and the other was a very conservative Republican, and they both said the same thing. What do you think about what they said?
Well, you know, I think that I would be very cautious with giving that message, because the truth is we don't really know what to expect. You know, we have predictions based on what's been seen in other countries, the trajectory of what we're seeing here in the United States, but I really think it's far too early to know how this is going to unfold. So while there's a possibility that it may be a brief period and go away, but I think that there's also a possibility, a very strong possibility, that this could really escalate. So I think the main message would be this is not a time to panic, but a time to prepare and a time to be alert to what's going on around us and to act accordingly and responsibly.
Dr. Centella, a vaccine is not yet available, and there's some thought that it, what, may not be available for over a year from now or so? Is that what you're hearing?
Yeah, I mean, the NIH, National Institutes of Health, which, you know, are our federal leaders when it comes to biomedical discovery and science, really say that it's going to be about 12 to 18 months before we have an FDA or Food and Drug Administration approved vaccine, which may seem like a long time and not going to ease anyone's concerns right now, but that's also a very, very quick, rapid timeline. In general, it takes, you know, 10, 15 years to go from discovery through safety trials and presenting the evidence to the FDA to make something publicly available. So the fact that their best guess and hope right now is 12 to 18 months, that's still a really you know, progressive timeline.
So let me follow up. It's kind of a two-part question there, because flu vaccines are obviously available now. Mm-hmm. If you get the flu, would that make you more vulnerable to getting COVID-19 because your immune system has been weakened? So with that in mind, would you recommend a number of people getting the flu vaccine now to help them prevent them from getting the flu?
Well, I'll let one of the clinicians answer that. But from my understanding, when an individual has had another respiratory illness like the flu, it may make them more susceptible to contracting something like COVID-19. So, you know, flu shots, I know people have a lot of thoughts around them. Why should I get it? I've never had the flu. We're this far into the season. I've been okay. Is it still worth it? You know, all these things are things that we talk about year after year. And while the flu vaccine certainly is not 100% effective, you know, I'd rather take a 40 or 50% effective vaccine than no vaccine. So that's my own thought about it.
Dr. Dunellen, did I pronounce your name correctly? And if I don't, please let me know, and I will make sure I do it for the rest of the program.
It's Dunellen.
Dunellen. Okay, Dunellen. Thank you for that. Do you want to take a crack at whether or not people should get the flu vaccine right now?
From the smart perspective, as long as we are still seeing people who are experiencing, you know, flu while still circulating in our communities, and it is, it's not too late to get a vaccine. That said, people need to understand that it takes approximately 2 weeks to start building sufficient antibodies for protection. So it's in this kind of late, you know, in the season, if someone gets a vaccine and then in 3 days they get diagnosed with flu, it's not that the vaccine gave them the flu, it's that the flu is prevalent in the community and the patient was exposed. That said, when I advise my patients and others about the vaccine, because of the fact that it's not 100% effective for all strains of the flu, I liken it to getting buying a lottery ticket. If you had a lottery ticket that said that you have a 30 to 40% chance of winning part of the pot, would you buy the lottery ticket? And I've yet to hear anyone say they wouldn't. So while it may be imperfect, it may be the difference between a mild illness and one that you need to be hospitalized for, or for if you do require hospitalization, it may keep you out of the intensive care unit, or, you know, it may be the difference between getting out of the intensive care unit and going home or going somewhere else. So there's a gradation of protection that shouldn't be wholeheartedly disregarded, in my opinion.
Okay. Dr. Banik, you get the first question from the listeners. And we have a listener asking, as a healthy person, how long should I stay away from others who might have been exposed to the virus? They say 14 days, but what then?
So I think that's a bit of a difficult question. In terms of the 14-day period, so that's based on the incubation period. So for instance, if someone was exposed to the virus, there would be potentially 14 days until that individual becomes sick with the virus. And during that period of time, there may be some potential for being contagious. So that pertains to an individual who's exposed. And then in terms of being exposed to an exposed person, that's sort of a more distant contact. So beyond staying away from the individual who's exposed during that incubation period, the standard infection prevention measures would be appropriate, things like frequent hand washing and staying away from others who are sick, not trying to avoid touching your face. Those sorts of prevention strategies would be appropriate.
So, Dr. Banik, well, I only have a minute before we have to take our first break. The listener also asks, are there any medications that can help prevent the virus or at least build resiliency?
So there are no antivirus medications that are available at this point for prevention. I think the key things are to really focus on health maintenance. So keeping yourself healthy, staying active, keeping your nutrition up. And then a big piece is if you do have any medical conditions, doing your best to optimize those is really important. We do know that people who have a lot of medical comorbidities are at highest risk, and really doing everything you can to try to maintain your health is really the key piece.
Dr. David Banik, Dr. Susan Donnellan, Dr. Anthony Santella, your questions, please send them to us on Facebook. You can find us at Full Story WSHU. If you are not a Facebook user, email them to us at tfs@wshu.org. We'll take our first break. We'll be right back. It's The Full Story on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak, and our program is live at 1 o'clock. Now, it is going to be played back this evening, as it normally does, at 7 o'clock. Between the time we are doing our broadcast live and when it gets played back tonight, the news is going to change. It changes almost every few minutes in terms of the coronavirus. So for the latest information about the coronavirus in Connecticut and New York, we ask you to go to our website, WSHU.org. You will find links there to our news coverage and to state and federal agencies that have more details about preventions and precautions. Once again, WSHU.org. Now, we have a number of experts with us for the remaining 40 minutes or so of the program. If you would like to ask them a question, we ask that you go to Facebook right now, Full Story WSHU. You can leave a question or a comment there, or you can email them to us at tfs@wshu.org. The experts who have been so kind to give us their time today, especially because, well, they're busy. There's no other way to say it. Dr. David Banik, who is an infectious disease doctor and hospital epidemiologist at UConn Health. Dr. Susan Donnellan, medical director of healthcare epidemiology at Stony Brook University Hospital. And Dr. Anthony Santella, associate professor of public health in the School of Health Professions and Human Services at Hofstra University. Dr. Santella, next question comes from a listener. We're having warmer days. Should we be worried? I thought cold weather and snow kill the coronavirus.
Well, we don't really know that. We do know that warm weather is associated with decreased cold and flu. Some viruses like the common cold and flu spread more during cold weather months, but that doesn't mean people can't get the cold or the flu in the springtime, for example. And at this time, we really don't know whether the spread of COVID-19 will decrease when it gets warmer. That's our hope. But there's nothing, that says that's for sure. As you mentioned earlier, this is constantly changing. So what we know about the science and the biology of this virus is being updated, as we speak. And so we still have to learn a lot more about how the virus is transmitted, how severe it is, and whether warm weather will really stop the outbreak.
Dr. Dinellen, here's a very interesting question. This is from one of the listeners. Can I catch the virus from stuff I order online from China or countries reporting COVID-19 cases?
I have actually heard that question more than once. We know from studies that have been done on other coronaviruses, there's four seasonal coronaviruses, they're four regular coronaviruses, and we know from studies that have been done on those that they may exist anywhere for several hours to perhaps a few days on non-porous surfaces. What has not been established or evaluated is whether it's going to be living on cardboard or that type of thing. But the time of transit between when something leaves a country versus the time that it lands up at your front door is variable. I think if there's a concern for that, then one would wash your hands, open the package or whatever it is, and then you wash your hands again. Again, it's the simple things. It gets back to hand hygiene and doing it correctly and avoiding touching your nose and your face when you are aware that your hands might be not as clean as you would prefer. I think our threat from it coming from inanimate objects that come from overseas is probably well overstated.
Dr. Banik, what about this question? We're being told to back off from other people. I mean, forget about handshakes and kissing and hugging nowadays. And then I read this morning that the virus can stay airborne for up to 6 feet. Is that accurate?
Well, I think the terminology becomes a little complex. So what we know about these virus particles is that they form droplets. So that's a little different than aerosols, which some viruses can actually form, and those allow the virus to travel for very long distances. In contrast, coronaviruses, at least based on our understanding of coronaviruses as a family of viruses, travel through droplets which extend to 6 feet. So you could propel a respiratory droplet about 6 feet. So It's not exactly what we would classify as airborne transmission, which pertains to those viruses that go far longer distances. But the 3 to 6 feet droplet projection is what's understood about coronaviruses in general.
Once again, if you have questions for our doctors, please join us on Facebook at Full Story WSHU. If you don't use Facebook, just send us Facebook. Just you send us an email. TFS@WSHU.org, TFS@WSHU.org. Dr. Santella, listener writes, can pets get the coronavirus?
I think the short answer is yes. From what I understand, even the low levels of virus in pets, like a domestic animal, like a cat or dog, can't do any harm to their owner. And again, you know, I don't want to sound like a broken record. You know, we're really reporting on what we know of science as of this morning. And when all of this is said and done, which there will come a time, hopefully in the near future, where we're able to kind of sit back and reflect and really put all the pieces together, I think we'll know more and scientists and government officials will be comfortable saying more. But for now, I wouldn't worry about that. I think where people make that connection, or why that is a question of curiosity for some individuals, is because the family of viruses that the coronaviruses are do appear in animals, particularly camels and bats, for example. And these are zoonotic illnesses that have spread from animals to humans. But we don't need to worry about either infecting our pets or our pets infecting us at this point.
Dr. Dinellen, how about this question from the listener? And I've seen a number of people wearing masks, and I'm wondering myself if this helps. Our listener asks, can masks really protect you? Can they protect against the virus?
I think the surgical masks that we're seeing people wear in public areas and whatnot are probably more out of fear than fact. Certainly, if I am not feeling well and I'm going to my physician, I would want to put a surgical mask on to prevent the spread of my problem to other people. But the surgical masks that we see people walking around with all day, they've never meant to be used all day. Once they become moistened, once they become frayed, they don't really provide the protection that one imagines that they would. They're really more for droplet containment and for protection in short distances between someone who, for example, is ill and cannot cover their nose or mouth, and a caregiver who needs to be close to them in order to help that sick person. But there really is not a role that is widespread and applicable for the general public to be wearing surgical masks.
Once again, the doctors are being very gracious today, giving us their precious time. So if you want to have your question answered by them, please contact us right away, tfs@wshu.org, Facebook, Full Story WSHU. Dr. Banik, you get the next question from the listener. Sharon writes, she stayed home from traveling this week because she has an underlying respiratory condition. Her family went ahead, they took the trip, and they're coming back later this week. What precautions should she take?
So I think the point you raised about someone who has an underlying medical condition is important. I think those are patients or individuals in the community that we need to be particularly concerned about, who, if they become infected, could get sicker than someone who does not have those conditions. I think that the general message is for individuals with those conditions to be sort of exercise an extra layer of caution, so really avoid travel, just like it sounds like your listener has, when feasible, and then to avoid kind of large gatherings also when possible, where there may just be an increased risk of becoming infected. As far as contact with other people who are traveling, I think we just have to be cognizant of our surroundings. For instance, if you notice that someone who's been traveling is developing symptoms, really keeping that distance would be a very a prudent thing to do, really trying to avoid that close contact with that individual. It comes down to a lot of the basic prevention measures that have been discussed already, things like hand hygiene making sure you're doing it correctly, trying to avoid touching your face, and if you're going to be doing that, coming near your face, doing hand hygiene before, would be the main focus in trying to avoid becoming infected.
Dr. Santella, I have a question before I get to the others from the listeners, because I read and see so much about trains and buses and dormitories, schools, state capitol buildings. They're all being scrubbed and disinfected nowadays. First, I have to ask you, does that help? Second, what if someone has COVID-19 and walks into that building that was just scrubbed and disinfected, but that person is sick and sneezes and coughs or whatever and touches the rails? What happens to all that hard work that was put into those buildings? Can you give us some guidance?
Mm-hmm. Well, the World Health Organization suggests right now that the coronaviruses could survive on surfaces really from a couple of hours to a few days. They're really not sure because there are a lot of things that influence how long it can be, active on a surface. Things like the temperature, how humid it is, the type of surface, et cetera. So that's why, it's kind of an approach that looks, a multifaceted approach to prevention, which includes the things that have already been said, like, washing your hands, alcohol-based hand sanitizer, and wiping down often touched surfaces with disinfectants. And the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, has put out a list to the public of approved wipes and other kinds of sprays that would work for the coronavirus. This is a matter also of kind of resource allocation. While some people have been critical about how institutions or local governments have been to respond, including, the wiping down of the subways and the trains and the MetroCard stations and all those things, there's only so much local government can do without compromising other services. So that's why states like New York and California have declared state of emergencies. That way they can get more resources from the federal government that can, help, pay people overtime and buy products and, you know, investigate price gouging and all these kinds of things. So when we combine all these efforts, which include things like wiping down the surfaces, avoiding person-to-person contact with people who are sick and all the things we've talked about, then we're all doing our part. Because this is not going to stop unless everyone from the listener who is, you know, listening to this interview today, to the local government, to the state government, to the federal government, to the scientists, do their part.
Dr. Donovan, Dr. Santella just brought up something interesting in terms of the MetroCard. I was reading earlier today, some doctors were saying, don't use cash. Cash, the greenbacks, are supposedly notorious germ carriers. And they're saying, if you're going to pay nowadays, tap and go, use your credit card, don't use cash. Is there anything to that?
Well, if you consider that cash and coins are passed through many hands, some people never have any cash with them, and they're constantly using their tap and go and that type of thing. Others don't have that capability. Again, it's going to get back to the basics that we've all been discussing, which is you pay cash for something, you get your change, you put your change in your pocket, and then you take an opportunity to perform hand hygiene, so that if you inadvertently need to touch your nose, your face, your mouth, then you've taken that opportunity. I think it's simply a matter of personal preference. It's not always an option for everyone, but hand hygiene certainly is an option for everyone. And I think that's really the point that I would see being more important.
Hmm. Dr. Banik, the other day I was eating something and a bit went down the wrong pipe and I coughed. And, you know, to be honest, I looked around to see if anyone was looking at me because I think everyone is on edge nowadays. How do we know when a cough is just a cough? When it's a sneeze, maybe allergic to something, or it's just a nasty head cold? How do we know that we should be maybe a bit more concerned nowadays?
Well, I mean, I think it's difficult because a lot of these respiratory viruses cause different symptoms in different people. So it can be difficult. You know, some things that, I'd encourage you to look for, if you notice that a cough is present for a very brief time and then goes away on its own, usually that would be, less concerning for one of these types of virus infections, especially if it's a cough in the setting of what sounds like you were having some choking. So something like that in terms of the trajectory of the symptoms. And then, of course, cough associated with a fever, cough associated with shortness of breath. You know, those kinds of things together would make you pause that maybe there's a little bit more to it. At that point, I'd suggest, contacting your provider. You know, if your symptoms are pretty mild, you know, a phone conversation, I think, would be appropriate. So contacting your provider over the phone, discussing your symptoms, and then determining if an in-person face-to-face visit would be appropriate.
Okay, with that minute that we have left before our final break, could I just pursue this one? Let's say this happens to you when you're at work. And maybe it is just the common cold, which, not to make light of it, may be a good thing for some people nowadays. If you have the common cold, should you go home? Should management ask you to stay home, maybe work from home?
Well, I think those are all important questions. I think when we're dealing with a situation like we are with COVID-19, I always err on the side of precaution. So if there is a possibility that you're able to complete your work from home and you do have very mild symptoms, not exactly sure what's going on in terms of the trajectory or the details, and you have the opportunity to go home, then by all means, I think anything that we can do to help distance from one another when we're having symptoms is really critical. That's going to be a big part of that in terms of preventing any spread of any of these viruses.
Dr. Santel, one of our listeners, writes, if I'm in isolation, how do I know when to leave?
Well, the short answer is, no one should be taking upon themselves to do any kind of self-quarantine or isolation without speaking to their healthcare provider. I think most employers and healthcare providers understand what's happening now and are making themselves more available, are, triaging other things that can wait or elective to really focus on treating people who need services. So no one, unless it's just, you know, you're feeling some, you know, feeling down or something like, you know, like was described earlier, like the common cold, and you have the flexibility and the luxury of being able to stay home and not go work and still get paid, right? That's a whole other story. Then, you know, just consult with your healthcare provider, because, you know, if we're just relying on, you know, the newspaper story or the TV, you know, what's broadcast on the news, we can't make those decisions for ourselves. We need guidance from clinicians.
Dr. Santella, hold on one second. I have to take a break. We have a number of questions from listeners. Facebook, Full Story, WSHU. Get your comments in now. Email us, tfs@wshu.org. We will try to get to almost all of them in the remaining few minutes. Stay with us. It's the Full Story on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak, and our program is live at 1 o'clock. Now, it is going to be played back this evening, as it normally does, at 7 o'clock. Between the time we are doing our broadcast live and when it gets played back tonight, the news is going to change. It changes almost every few minutes in terms of the coronavirus. So for the latest information about the coronavirus in Connecticut and New York, we ask you to go to our website, wshu.org. You will find links there to our news coverage and to state and federal agencies that have more details about preventions and precautions. Once again, wshu.org. Now, we have a number of experts with us for the remaining 40 minutes or so of the program. If you would like to ask them a question, we ask that you go to Facebook right now, Full Story WSHU. You can leave a question or a comment there, or you can email them to us at tfs@wshu.org. The experts who have been so kind to give us their time today, especially because, well, they're busy. There's no other way to say it. Dr. David Banik, who is an infectious disease doctor and hospital epidemiologist at UConn Health. Dr. Susan Donnellan, medical director of healthcare epidemiology at Stony Brook University Hospital. And Dr. Anthony Santella, associate professor of public health in the School of Health Professions and Human Services at Hofstra University. Dr. Santella, next question comes from a listener. We're having warmer days. Should we be worried? I thought cold weather and snow kill the coronavirus.
Well, we don't really know that. You know, we do know that warm weather is associated with decreased cold and flu. Some, you know, viruses like the common cold and flu spread more during cold weather months, but that doesn't mean people can't get the cold or the flu in the springtime, for example. And at this time, we really don't know whether the spread of COVID-19 will decrease when it gets warmer. That's our hope. But there's nothing, you know, that says that's for sure. As you mentioned earlier, you know, this is constantly changing. So what we know about the science and the biology of this virus is being updated, you know, as we speak. And so we still have to learn a lot more about how the virus is transmitted, how severe it is, and whether warm weather will really stop the outbreak.
Dr. Donnellan, here's a very interesting question. This is from one of the listeners. Can I catch the virus from stuff I order online from China or countries reporting COVID-19 cases?
I have actually heard that question more than once. We know from studies that have been done on other coronaviruses, there's four seasonal coronaviruses, they're four regular coronaviruses, and we know from studies that have been done on those that they may exist anywhere for several hours to perhaps a few days on non-porous surfaces. What has not been established or evaluated is whether it's going to be living on cardboard or that type of thing, but the time of transit between when something leaves a country versus the time that it lands up at your front door is variable. I think if there's a concern for that, then one would wash your hands, open the package or whatever it is, and then you wash your hands again. Again, it's the simple things. It gets back to hand hygiene and doing it correctly and avoiding touching your nose and your face when you are aware that your hands might be not as clean as you would prefer. I think our threat from it coming from inanimate objects that come from overseas is probably well overstated.
Dr. Banik, what about this question? We're being told to back off from other people. I mean, forget about handshakes and kissing and hugging nowadays. And then I read this morning that the virus can stay airborne for up to 6 feet. Is that accurate?
Well, I think the terminology becomes a little complex. So what we know about these virus particles is that they form droplets. So that's a little different than aerosols, which some viruses can actually form, and those allow the virus to travel for very long distances. In contrast, coronaviruses, at least based on our understanding of coronaviruses as a family of viruses, travel through droplets which extend to 6 feet. So you could propel a respiratory droplet about 6 feet. So it's not exactly what we would classify as airborne transmission, which pertains to those viruses that go far longer distances, but the 3 to 6 feet droplet projection is what's understood about coronaviruses in general.
Once again, if you have questions for our doctors, please join us on Facebook at Full Story WSHU. If you don't use Facebook, just send us Facebook. Just you send us an email, tfs@wshu.org, tfs@wshu.org. Dr. Santella, listener writes, can pets get the coronavirus?
I think the short answer is yes. From what I understand, even the low levels of virus in pets, like a domestic animal, like a cat or dog, can't do any harm to their owner. And again, you know, I don't want to sound like a broken record. You know, we're really reporting on what we know of science as of this morning. And when all of this is said and done, which there will come a time, hopefully in the near future, where we're able to kind of sit back and reflect and really put all the pieces together, I think we'll know more and scientists and government officials will be comfortable saying more. But for now, I wouldn't worry about that. I think where people make that connection or why that is a question of curiosity for some individuals is because the family of viruses that the coronaviruses are do appear in animals, particularly camels and bats, for example. And these are zoonotic illnesses that have spread from animals to humans. But we don't need to worry about either infecting our pets or our pets infecting us at this point.
Dr. Dinellen, how about this question from the listener? And I've seen a number of people wearing masks, and I'm wondering myself if this helps. Our listener asks, can masks really protect you? Can they protect against the virus?
I think the surgical masks that we're seeing people wear in public areas and whatnot are probably more out of fear than fact. Certainly, if I am not feeling well and I'm going to my physician, I would want to put a surgical mask on to prevent the spread of my problem to other people. But the surgical masks that we see people walking around with all day, they've never meant to be used all day. Once they become moistened, once they become frayed, they don't really provide the protection that one imagines that they would. They're really more for droplet containment and for protection in short distances between someone who, for example, is ill and cannot cover their nose or mouth, and a caregiver who needs to be close to them in order to help that sick person. But there really is not a role that is widespread and applicable for the general public to be wearing surgical masks.
Once again, the doctors are being very gracious today, giving us their precious time. So if you want to have your question answered by them, please contact us right away, tfs@wshu.org, Facebook, Full Story WSHU. Dr. Banik, you get the next question from the listener. Sharon writes, she stayed home from traveling this week because she has an underlying respiratory condition. Her family went ahead. They took the trip, and they're coming back later this week. What precautions should she take?
So I think you know, the point you raised about someone who has an underlying medical condition is important. I think you know, those are patients or individuals in the community that we need to be particularly concerned about, who, if they become infected, could get sicker than someone who would, does not have those conditions. And you know, I think that the general message is for individuals with those conditions to be sort of exercise an extra layer of caution. So really avoid travel, just like it sounds like your listener has. When feasible, and then to avoid kind of large gatherings also when possible, where there may just be an increased risk of becoming infected. You know, as far as contact with other people who are traveling, you know, I think, you know, we just have to be cognizant of our surroundings. For instance, if you notice that someone who's been traveling is developing symptoms, you know, really keeping that distance would be a very a prudent thing to do, and really trying to avoid that close contact with that individual. And then, you know, it comes down to a lot of the basic prevention measures that have been discussed already, things like hand hygiene and you know, making sure you're doing it correctly, trying to avoid touching your face, and if you're going to be doing that, coming near your face, doing hand hygiene before, would be the main focus in trying to avoid becoming infected.
Dr. Santella, I have a question before I get to the others from the listeners, because I read and see so much about trains and buses and dormitories, schools, state capitol buildings. They're all being scrubbed and disinfected nowadays. First, I have to ask you, does that help? Second, what if someone has COVID-19 and walks into that building that was just scrubbed and disinfected, but that person is sick and sneezes and coughs or whatever and touches the rails? What happens to all that hard work that was put into those buildings? Can you give us some guidance?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the World Health Organization suggests right now that the coronaviruses could survive on surfaces, you know, really from a couple of hours to a few days. They're really not sure because there are a lot of things that influence how long it can be, you know, active on the surface. Things like the temperature, how humid it is, the type of surface, et cetera. So that's why, you know, it's kind of an approach that looks, a multifaceted approach to prevention, which includes the things that have already been said, like, you know, washing your hands, alcohol-based hand sanitizer, and wiping down often touched surfaces with disinfectants. And the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, has put out a list to the public of approved wipes and other kinds of sprays that would work for the coronavirus. And, you know, this is a matter also of kind of resource allocation. While some people have been critical about how institutions or local governments have been to respond, including, you know, the wiping down of the subways and the trains and the MetroCard stations and all those things, there's only so much local government can do without compromising other services. So that's why states like New York and California have declared state of emergencies. That way they can get more resources from the federal government that can, you know, help, you know, pay people overtime and buy products and, you know, investigate price gouging and all these kinds of things. So when we combine all these efforts, which include things like wiping down the surfaces, avoiding person-to-person contact with people who are sick and all the things we've talked about, then we're all doing our part. This is not going to stop unless everyone from the listener who's, you know, listening to this interview today, to the local government, to the state government, to the federal government, to the scientists, do their part.
Dr. Donovan, Dr. Santella just brought up something interesting in terms of the MetroCard. I was reading earlier today, some doctors were saying, don't use cash. Cash, the greenbacks, are supposedly notorious germ carriers. And they're saying, if you're going to pay nowadays, tap and go, use your credit card, don't use cash. Is there anything to that?
Well, if you consider that cash and coins are passed through many hands, some people never have any cash with them, and they're constantly using their tap and go and that type of thing. Others don't have that capability. Again, it's going to get back to the basics that we've all been discussing, which is, you know, you pay cash for something, you get your change, you put your change in your pocket. And then you take an opportunity to perform hand hygiene so that if you inadvertently need to touch your nose, your face, your mouth, then you've taken that opportunity. I think it's simply a matter of personal preference. It's not always an option for everyone, but hand hygiene certainly is an option for everyone. And I think that's really the point that I would see being more important.
Dr. Banik, the other day I was eating something and a bit went down the wrong pipe and I coughed. And, you know, to be honest, I looked around to see if anyone was looking at me because I think everyone is on edge nowadays. How do we know when a cough is just a cough, when it's a sneeze, maybe allergic to something, or it's just a nasty head cold? How do we know that we should be maybe a bit more concerned nowadays?
Well, I mean, I think it's difficult because a lot of these respiratory viruses cause different symptoms in different people. So it can be difficult. You know, some things that, I'd encourage you to look for, if you notice that a cough is present for a very brief time and then goes away on its own, usually that would be, less concerning for one of these types of virus infections, especially if it's a cough in the setting of what sounds like you were having some choking. So something like that in terms of the trajectory of the symptoms. And then, of course, cough associated with a fever, cough associated with shortness of breath. You know, those kinds of things together would make you pause that maybe there's a little bit more to it. At that point, I'd suggest, contacting your provider. You know, if your symptoms are pretty mild, you know, a phone conversation, I think, would be appropriate. So contacting your provider over the phone, discussing your symptoms, and then determining if an in-person face-to-face visit would be appropriate.
Okay, with that minute that we have left before our final break, could I just pursue this one? Let's say this happens to you when you're at work. And maybe it is just the common cold, which, not to make light of it, may be a good thing for some people nowadays. If you have the common cold, should you go home? Should management ask you to stay home, maybe work from home?
Well, I think those are all important questions. I think when we're dealing with a situation like we are with COVID-19, I always err on the side of precaution. So if there is a possibility that you're able to complete your work from home and you do have very mild symptoms, not exactly sure what's going on in terms of the trajectory or the details, and you have the opportunity to go home, then by all means, I think anything that we can do to help distance from one another when we're having symptoms is really critical. That's going to be a big part of that in terms of preventing any spread of any of these viruses.
Dr. Santel, one of our listeners, writes, if I'm in isolation, how do I know when to leave?
Well, the short answer is, no one should be taking upon themselves to do any kind of self-quarantine or isolation without speaking to their healthcare provider. I think most employers and healthcare providers understand what's happening now and are making themselves more available, are, triaging other things that can wait or elective to really focus on treating people who need services. So no one, unless it's just, you're feeling something, feeling down or something like, like was described earlier, like the common cold, and you have the flexibility and the luxury of being able to stay home and not go to work and still get paid, right? That's a whole other story. Then, just consult with your healthcare provider because, if we're just relying on, the newspaper story or the TV, what's cast on the news, we can't make those decisions for ourselves. We need guidance from clinicians.
Dr. Santel, hold on. Hold on one second. I have to take a break. We have a number of questions from listeners. Facebook, Full Story WSHU. Get your comments in now. Email us, tfs@wshu.org. We will try to get to almost all of them in the remaining few minutes. Stay with us.